Captain Griffiths, reel two.
Now that explains roughly the system of finding them and them helping us towards, it would be August 43, we had another gadgetry, and that was called S-phones. All these names are really done to confuse the enemy and confuse ourselves at times. But S-phones, at that time, was a miracle aid. It was on the UHF, a very ultra-high frequency. And we knew the Germans hadn't got them. So in its extreme form, you could have a man with his batteries round his waist and a transmitter, and he could run cable up his arm and use an umbrella, even as an aerial, and he could chat to the aircraft overhead from the ground. And indeed, I had the experience of heading for the place we'd been given near Bordeaux, and we were within about 10 minutes when we spoke to see if we could get them, and a voice came up saying, "Your dropping zone is brûlé," which means that it was compromised. "Keep coming south." So we kept on going south, and we were directed by the man on the ground when he heard our engines, and he brought us right over the torches in a completely different place. And then the operator of the S-phones aboard had a chat with him, as an SOE chap, and we then hovered in the area. I don't know whether they had a tape recorder or just made notes, but we got a lot of good gen on that. And that was S-phones, which came in after 43. I was a bit sorry, in a way, for the man on the ground, because it was a hefty piece of equipment at that stage to hang around. And if you did get it, you could get it onto a bicycle if you were pushed, but I mean, if you were stopped and searched, it was too hot to have. But nevertheless, it was a good thing. Now, the other thing that was good were two Eureka beacons. Now, some hero, I don't know who they were, but they climbed to the top of the two churches, Reims Cathedral, that's R-H-E-I-M-S, and another one, which was on the Loire. I'm not certain whether it was Tours, T-O-U-R-S. And the signal would be given out, and it was there all... It didn't operate until you transmitted from your aircraft, and then it would give you your mileage from it. So at low down, you weren't doing too well, but if you were getting a little bit foxed and wanted to know where you were, you could pull up to 1,000 feet, and you get a reading off both, almost. It was very good in that respect. So that was what I termed good ecclesiastical cooperation. And they had the names of Boot and Shoe. Boot was the Reims one, or you could use an English word, and Shoe was the other one down at Tours. So they were quite useful. As the war went on, of course, more and more of this gadgetry came on. But of course, what you really had to bear in mind, which I think we were, well, it wasn't our job to say in the design that this was risky, because the people positioning themselves, if they got the 1 o'clock notice on the BBC, that would mean we are aiming to come tonight. the 5 to 6 one in the evening would mean it is on, it's firm. So they had to get, many of them from where they worked, and get to this field to receive before curfew. They'd have to be there, as a rule, say, before dark. They had to wait till 1 or 2 in the morning until we arrived. And then we'd drop our load, some of which were 20 containers, and that's a big load to get rid of and to hide. Then they wouldn't get back to, they couldn't get back to work or to civilization again until curfew was finished. So they didn't get much sleep that night. The other again, they might wait all night long and the aircraft might not come. It could be shot down on the way. There were big disappointments like that. On the other hand, terrific feeling of elation on the ground when this shower of parachutes would come down and silk was distributed amongst all the ladies in the area, you know. It was great. As you had a great feeling when you'd done the job and done it quickly. In many cases, you would, on coming in to the drop, you would work out beforehand what the wind was. I was very keen on this. I think it saved me time and time again. You would work out which way the wind was, and then you would come in, and if the lights were right and they got them set decently, you could let your road go. One run over, finish. Then you went off to the nearest town, threw out newspapers, leaflets, to disguise what you were doing so that the Germans could think that it was a trainee crew going somewhere quiet just for navigational purposes. And then you also had, there were three types of drop. There were the pigeons, the men, and then the packages and containers. The packages would be on roller conveyor, and they had to go out of the door or right through the Joe's hole in the floor to get rid of. But the pigeons we were very careful with. I suppose that the British are always a bit nuts when it comes to animals, but the pigeon would go down in his little box with a tiny parachute, and whichever way he landed, it wouldn't he wouldn't be hurt. He'd still be in the box, and you'd hope that he'd be found. They were highly coloured, so you could spot them. And if the pigeon was 2 or 3 days, he could peck through to some grain and to some water inside, which should always be at the bottom, you know. It was quite extraordinary, very humane. And we got some lovely things back. Sometimes you get a terribly rude answer. There's rice paper and things to write with inside. And the pigeon would have it put in his leg and come back. Messages were from the Germans. They'd found them. Some, of course, I'm jolly certain, got eaten in some places where food was short. Though, mark you, as I discovered later, there was never any shortage of food where I was on the continent. And then we had some splendid messages. One was a simple thing from somebody unknown in a small town inland, about 10 miles inland from the Normandy beaches, Argentan. I think I'm right saying it's Argentan. And it said, on the rice paper, which the pigeon brought back, the baker is a collaborator. Can you do something about it? The other thing was, at the far end of the town, they gave a fairly good description. A telephone exchange is being constructed, which we now know is a headquarters for the coastal defenses. Now, so far as we know, they dealt with the Baker separately. Now, we needn't go out and take the Baker out. We would get in touch with our agent at the other end and say, now, just check on this. Is it true? And then he would come back, di-da-di-da-di. Yes. So that the fellow would know that his message had been received, we took out the Baker's place one morning about 4:30 with a mosquito. And, of course, he'd know then that it had been taken out, all of this due to a pigeon. And then we took out the telephone exchange before D-Day. We waited until D-Day, and then we knew what it was. So this is a sort of results of dropping a pigeon. You would try and drop a pigeon, if possible. I used to like farms, because, and if you could do a really accurate drop somewhere near the buildings, then you'd get it back all right. Dropping it in the street, people wouldn't like to be seen picking it up in case somebody reported them. But and you're the next day, you were sort of full of excitement, saying, now, has he come back? And you'd hear whether your pigeon had made it or not. Some of the pigeons might take 3 to 7 days to get back. There was a system. I'd love to know how it was all worked. But at first, they were let fly on submarines or mortar torpedo boats under training. And then gradually, they'd go to France, and you'd find one that was particularly good, and he would come back as far as Lyon, which is a long way. And we got a lot of good information on the pigeons. And we try to be very humane and give them a good drop. Men, we were fussy about. We went to at least 800 feet. I know we started dropping, I think, at 600. And it didn't allow... 600 feet was all right for a professional parachutist. He could disentangle himself if it was a foul line or something like that. But when you're dealing with a man who's only had, say, a fortnight's training, you want to give him 800 feet to sort himself out in case there's a thrown line over the canopy or something like that. So we were dropping men for about 800. And also, the higher you drop them, the more inaccurate the landing. If you wanted to get them into a certain field with lights, the lower you were, they had a more accurate landing, of course. Against that, if they got a foul parachute, they wouldn't get it clear themselves, because you can clear a lot of faults. And no reserves were carried. Reserves didn't come in till 1958. So it was altogether a very successful, because I know that on the ground, towards the end of the war, we reckoned that we only had one malfunction every 145,000 drops. That's pretty good for personnel parachutes. I had the station with the parachute school on it. So that was the parachute side of it, just the pigeons and the men. And the men we dropped at about 120 miles an hour. It gives you a terrific jerk if you go much faster. And so it was a question with the men of being really steady on the run-in, flaps down, wheels down as well to help the reducer speed, and try to drop them at 800 feet and about 120. And so then, of course, a lot of men didn't like to go to receptions. They liked to drop blind. If they were going to receptions, something might have been, the reception committee might have been caught. And this happened, we had this ghastly business in Holland, whereby for nearly a year we were dropping to the Germans. They got our, it was called, the best story is in a book called Inside North Pole, and it is by a Dutchman, and it explains he was in North Pole, which is a prison, and they got the first pianist we dropped over to an organization. Pianist is a radio signaler, and I must explain some of these words. A Joe is any agent. Pianist is a signaler. And this first chap dropped, they got him. And I don't know how we messed it up. There's a sad story behind it. But when the man transmitted any time, he from the continent, he made a deliberate mistake, absolutely deliberate. And if that wasn't in, there was something wrong. You know, it meant suspect message, if somebody got a revolver against my head. And we missed that on the first one that we dropped in Holland. I don't know how it happened. And I think they collected a total of 32. But they had to keep them alive in order to send us messages. It's a most intriguing story.
How many of those agents do you think you might have dropped?
I came in, thank goodness, at the time when we were suspicious. The flying crews had been suspicious for, I'd say, several moons. You see, we only flew virtually 14 days out of a month, or could fly, but when the moon was bright enough. And of those 14 days, you might do three in a row, and you might do six or nine, perhaps, to push of those days. Now, with the dropping of signalers, that they were all caught, and they went in the bag. Now, we air crews were suspicious, and people seem to get a very easy run in, and then the aircraft would disappear on the way out. Not all of them, but it was a rough ride out. The torches were excellent, typical German, so bloody perfect, you know, whereas with others there'd be weak batteries or they wouldn't be in a straight line and so on and so forth. But people used to say, God, these Dutch are efficient, you know. And all the time we were dropping to the Germans while I was there. Now, people got suspicious. I've got the dates there. And one man got out of North Pole and he got to Switzerland. And he said, look, you're dropping to the Germans. He told us, we couldn't believe it. It's absolutely extraordinary. I think the air crews, we were suspicious, but we still went on dropping to them. And I can't tell you that story, it's not my business now, but I took over two people, and they wanted to go blind. We dropped them, having done a reception on one first. We dropped them, and indeed on that reception I did the old trick of going straight to it, not turning, and getting rid of the stuff, and then going off with the Joe in the back to drop. And we dropped him blind, and he got down all right, and I met him after the war. The second one was a man called... he was sent over, not by SOE especially, but by our escape organization. And he was actually, he could speak Dutch, and I think, a Norwegian citizen. But he did sterling work by sorting out the escapees that were in Holland. Now, he went blind, and I think he just didn't want to go to reception in case. And That was the second one. And then after that, we stopped dropping altogether. Absolutely. They that spilled the beans. But the story of the way the Germans foxed us, and I'm happy in one way, because it wasn't the Gestapo, people always talk about the Gestapo, it was the Abwehr, ABVRT, who were the people who handled the post, and I think they all lived. It's quite extraordinary. The chaps who were doing the signalling and are all captured in North Pole. Must get it clear in my mind. I keep mixing up Poles and Poland and Nord Pole, NORDPOL, which was a prison.
Was there anything else apart from the efficiency of the tortures which made you suspicious?
Yes, they were using the same dropping zone too often. We would get a request. Now, this is quite intriguing. We would get a request. Now, in France, Denmark and places, you would get a dropping zone. You very rarely went to the same place twice. But in Holland, they were dropping quite near to their headquarters. I only know of three places in Holland where it must have been night after night, and this was why the crews were suspicious. And you say, oh, not again, you know. And the reason for it is in this book on Norpo. The officer in charge of intelligence used to go out for the drops, and he didn't like to have to drive far. And so he always had a drop at the bottom end of the Zuider Zee in the woods there. And this was, it stood out like a sore thumb. And I think that was a thing which, and the lights being so good, because if they'd had to get things on the black market or get them charged, it would have been different. So that was the Dutch fiasco.
Who did you report your suspicions to? Who did you report your suspicions to?
We spoke to, of course, our own debriefing on coming back. That's when we'd say, you used to get a hammering. I know this, that one of the, I've got the translation from the German on this, that they had briefed the anti-aircraft guns, which they had on these receptions, and said, the aircraft will come over and he will identify the place and he'd fly over. Don't shoot at him the first time. Wait till the second. And I think that is what saved us. Coupled with the fact that I used to drop first time, if I could, and then they didn't open up. And the second thing was, they had fighters waiting to get us as we went back up the Zuider Zee. The standard way in which I used was the middle of the island called to Schelling. And that's right. Or is that one of the German ones? Anyway, by crossing the centre of this island, sandbank, off the coast, no guns in the middle. They were out for stopping the mining. So they used to put their guns for aircraft on the ends where the water passage was. We found by going across the centre, it was clearer. Then you'd hit the great bund of the Zuider Zee, which was a hell of a height. It was, I think, at least 30, 40 feet out of the water, like jumping up a Grand National fence on a horse. And you'd get over the top of the bund, and then it was water all the way down. Now, they could, when we come back, if you came back up the Zuider Zee, I'm sure they could spot our reflection, and we'd be very low down, and they'd turn their fighters onto us. Now, I think the reason, and this is only my own theory, why we survived as a crew on Holland was the fact that we had in the back bags of chocolates, and we used to go off after doing the drop, turn off and go up the east side of Holland and pick out little villages and drop chocolates and things off and pamphlets, and it was rather fun. I liked sticking to the countryside and keeping away from big towns and keeping away from the water, for one thing. And we used to go very low down, and we often saw enemy aircraft and passed enemy airfields with them going into land, and yet they never worried us. And I think that's why, because we didn't know where the hell we were going ourselves. We used to wander up, keeping roughly the Zuider Zee on our left. And I think that's why we made it. I only did about five trips, I think, but and it was right at the end, so they were getting very sticky. That was Holland. Belgium, we could always get into Belgium from the south side. They used to go across into France, round Paris. You wouldn't mind flying an extra hour knowing you weren't going to get shot at, and you began to know your way about. And also, you see, you could, in the morning, you could see what was wanted doing, and they would say, how about you doing that? And you say, oh yeah, that'd suit me fine. And if fine weather came in with a high pressure system, you'd follow it across Europe. You could do it when it had just hit the French coast and work on and follow that for, say, two or three nights. And what more do you want? To fly an aeroplane in good weather into remote parts where there's no guns and nobody to shoot at you. You could go on forever and a day. And that's what I thought, but it didn't quite do that. Yes.
You mentioned Dairy Corps. Did you have any suspicions?
I had nothing to do with him, but of course I've read everything I can afterwards, and I know Hugh Verity. He was there with me, and Hugh Verity was I really don't know. He couldn't believe that Vericourt was working for the other side, and many people. The point is, he got away with the inquiry after the war. You do wonder, things cross your mind. Was it that he had a relative being held, perhaps his wife, I don't know, being held by the Germans, and therefore was forced into an uncompromising position? And he gave away certain things.
But do I understand you had nothing to do with Dairy Corps at the time?
No, 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 no. In fact, that was done entirely way above our heads. He was brought over to England once.